the Bible about pride as I was looking up the different verses that it offered in the book, I was amazed at how much the Bible talks about pride. So this was an enjoyable chapter to go over. No, I'm not. I was trying to do my PowerPoint. I'm not going to worry about it. They were just a couple of movie clips that I wanted to show that went with pride, but how do I get up my...
Oh, you might have to ask someone who's familiar with the projector.
Okay, sorry guys. I've got it here. Oh, that's...
That was under a key. Do you know how to do that?
It's back here.
Go away.
Oh.
Instead of computer in.
Uh-huh.
It might affect it.
There we go. Oh.
Oh, you got the upside down.
So yep.
Just got to...
After this, we'll be pros at this. Yeah.
Is it just my glasses or is that out of focus?
It's out of focus.
Yeah, it's a fixed state, making it less blurry.
No, your eyes are just getting really bad,
Tim. That's what I was wondering.
The least of our worries is still early in the day.
It's an age thing.
New prescription.
I just got new glasses. I hope they're not wrong. There we go. Thank you very much. Okay. And real quick, how does this go full?
Go to slideshow up the top.
Thank you. Okay.
Up at the very top of the menus going across.
Gotcha. Thank you.
And from the beginning.
Excuse me?
To the left.
All the way to the,
left.
Upper left.
I'm lost. Oh, okay. Gotcha. Okay, cool. Thank you. All right, we are good to go. Maybe. Yep, we are. I learned quick, thank God. Okay, so like I said, with each chapter, it starts with a scriptural verse that bases the chapter off of it. So I'll read that to you now. Love is not the world, neither the things in the world. If any man love the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all this is in the world, the lust of the flesh and the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life is not, and the pride of life is not of the Father, but is of the world, and the world passeth away, and the lust thereof. But he that doeth the will of God abideth forever. And this is in 1 John chapter 2, 15 to 17. So, why do people persist in sin? Why do they persist in sin in a Christian home? We commit sin daily. We commit sins daily that are not permeated, yet we have, premeditated, yet we have a hard time apologizing for sin, confessing it, or making restitution. It is because of pride that we will put off doing these things, and pride is premeditated sin. Okay. Pride is a sin that God hates above all other sins. I marked my Bible today, and this particular chapter does have a lot of quick scriptures, so I'm not going to, for the sake of time and stuff, ask anybody to read them. I'll just read them for you. I've gotten used to talking a lot again since school started up, so I'm good to go here. The first one is Proverbs chapter 6, verses 16 and 17, and it says, "These six things doth the Lord hate, yea, seven are an abomination unto him, a proud look, a lying tongue, and hands that shed innocent blood." Pride, along with other sins, comes from within us and defiles us. Mark chapter 7, verses 22 and 23 speak on this. theft, covetousness, wickedness, deceit, lasciviousness, an evil eye, blasphemy, pride, foolishness. All these evil things come from within and defile the man. Then God insults the very appearance of pride. Psalm 73, verses 6 and 7 speak on this. Therefore, pride compasseth them about as a chain. Violence covereth them as a garment. Their eyes stand out with fatness. They have more than heart could wish. Many Christian parents allow pride in their home. What do the scriptures say about pride? Before I do that, let me jump back to many Christian parents allow pride in their home. There's so much in the book, and I've never really outlined a book before, so I found it a bit challenging to figure out what exactly to put on my outline. So I basically wrote it for me as a reminder of what things I want to speak on. Let's see. Where am I? Here we go. When we think of, let's see, behold, blah, 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 blah. All right. It's not popping out at me right now, so maybe we'll just skip over it. But I do know that it's tricky when you're a parent and you do have children and you do have a lot of pride in the home. It is kind of easy to overlook it. I've seen it at times myself with students, and I've seen it at times myself with my own children, or even my husband or myself, perhaps. And it's something that you don't really pay a lot of attention to, but you have to, and you have to be careful, because if you don't, it can become bigger and a worse problem. What do the scriptures say about pride? Ezekiel chapter 16, verse 49 says, sorry. Behold, this was the iniquity of the sister Sodom. Pride, fullness of bread, and abundance of idleness was in her and in her daughters. Neither did she strengthen the hand of the poor and the needy. And then Psalm chapter 10, verses 2 and 4 says, 2 through 4 says, the wicked in his pride doth persecute the poor. Let them be taken in the devices that they have imagined. For the wicked boasted of his heart's desire and blessed the covetous whom the Lord abhorred. The wicked through the pride of his covetous countenance will not seek after God, but is not in all his thoughts. Sorry, let's try that again. The wicked through the pride of his countenance will not seek after God. God is not in all his thoughts. Sorry, I think I'm still a little nervous about being up here. God hates pride, and so should we. Proverbs 8:13 speaks on this, and it says, the fear of the Lord is to hate evil, pride, and arrogancy, and the evil way, and the froward mouth do I hate. And then God does not leave pride alone. Leviticus 26:19. And I will break the pride of your power. I will make your heaven an iron and your earth and as brass. And then lastly, shame follows pride. Proverbs chapter 11, 2. What pride cometh, then cometh shame. When pride cometh, then cometh shame. But with the lowly is wisdom. And then Proverbs 29:23 says, a man's pride shall bring him low, but honor shall uphold the humble in spirit. And then lastly, Proverbs 15, 18. Actually, no, I'm going to skip that one because when I looked it up, it didn't follow suit with what I was doing. So that one I'm not going to read. Parents lead by example when asking forgiveness for their transgressions. With all the scriptures about pride, it says, what should be done when parents or a husband is not willing, or a husband will not deal with flagrant sin appropriately? I jumped ahead of myself, sorry. Okay, back to when, not surprisingly, God does not leave pride alone, and I will break, anyway, all of that. Of course, we also remember the famous passage, pride go before destruction and a haughty spirit before a fall. That's the one that I had written 15, but it was supposed to be 16. Speaking of church office, Paul mentions this in his discussion of elder qualifications. He says, not a novice, lest being lifted up with pride, he fall into the condemnation of the devil. Husbands and wives should consider that these are also offices, and as parents, they hold an additional office. Pride is unbecoming and grotesque in any official, particularly when the office is an office of the home. So he really just mostly quotes a lot of scriptures through here to just give examples. He doesn't really talk much on it as far as teaching it. He's just basically in this chapter pointing out what the Bible says about pride, and is just showing us through scripture what the Bible is saying about pride. Yes, Paul, sorry.
Well, I'm not sure if when you paused and forgot that one thing you were looking for, I wonder if it was that thing about Sodom.
Yes, it was, and I found it again back here. When we think of sin of Sodom, we often forget the central sin. Because the cause of all the other we often forget the central sin, the cause of all the other problems. The great problem in Sodom was not sodomy, but pride. The sexual perversion was a later development. The pride was first. And then it goes on to say, and yet there are many Christian parents who are outraged at sins like sodomy, but they nurture the mother of this perversion around their own dining room table. They defend it, they cherish it. It is their precious. Prideful people do not consider the poor and needy, and in a family, the children are the poor and needy, but pride does not care. Thank you. Yes, that's what I was trying to get at. I don't have much to say on that other than, you know, just that I see it a lot in kids today, and I don't think parents talk to their children enough. I think they talk over them or around them, but they don't actually talk with them. And I don't see that they lead by example as much anymore because just what I see mostly in the classroom when kids come in, it makes me wonder where their priorities are and what they really talk about, or do they even talk? Like I said, going back to before, families are very busy today, and I don't believe that they... I don't think that they spend enough time with each other talking like they used to, and you're starting to see the results of it. And pride is definitely one of them. When pride rules, if the protector of the home is guilty of stubbornness and pride, then those in the home are to be protected suffer for this. Because of our sinful nature, sin is always present in the home. How we deal with that sin is the question. If the husband is guilty of pride, the whole family will suffer. If both parents are living poorly, then it places the children under disobedient authority. On the part about the husband... Well, I think I put it in my notes, so let's go on. It was a pretty short section, and it didn't go too far with it. But it does go on to say that what is the correct response when the parents or just one parent will not deal with the sin that is obvious to see? And this is very good. I really like this. However, it's not easy to do. It requires a lot of growth on your part to be able to do this. And it definitely comes only through the grace of God and a lot of prayer. And that is, first, as the wife or the child, the first thing is to remember to trust God, understanding that you were placed in the family by God. Do not become part of the sin problem by becoming resentful, bitter, or through provoking actions or words. That's definitely hard to do. And it really takes a strong Christian spirit and a lot of prayer, because I think today a lot of families break up for these reasons. You know, the husband's refusing to admit he's made a mistake or he's made a wrong decision, or the wife, and they just come to the agreement that, well, we just don't get along, instead of trying to be the bigger person, or in this case, be the more Christian person, say, okay, right now, you know, he's not seeing what's going on, and we're just going to pray, and I'm just going to trust God that he'll help him. Because we do that now with each other. You know, there are times when even in our marriages we have a difference of opinion or something, and you go in prayer individually, but if you're a good, strong couple, you'll go in prayer together. But if you know that you're being wronged by your spouse, you will pray for them, and you will ask God to help them to be able to see what they're not seeing. And that doesn't happen far too often, because it takes a strong Christian person to be able to do that. Most of us want to just get frustrated and fed up and throw our hands up and say, look, I'm done. Guard your heart against the urge to do any of these. Be ready to forgive at any moment that the opportunity arises. And lastly, work to be an example of obedience to God's scriptures as shown in 1 Peter chapter 3, verses 1 through 6. This one I didn't mark, but I want to look it up because what was it? 1 through 6? Likewise, ye wives, be in subjection to your own husbands, that if any obey not the word, they also may without the word be won by the conversation of the wives, while they behold your chaste conversation coupled with fear, whose adorning let it not be that outward adorning of plaiting the hair, and of wearing gold, or of putting on of apparel, but let it be the hidden man of the heart, in that which is not corruptible, even the ornament of a meek and quiet spirit, which is in the sight of God of great price. For after this manner in the old time, the holy women also, who trusted in God, adorned themselves, being in subjection unto their own husbands, even as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord, whose daughters ye are, as long as ye do well, and are not afraid with any amazement. That's just it. You know, we do have to be in subjection to each other. And when it comes to your children, you have to be careful and do well, because if you don't catch it when it's early, then you do have some very angry, frustrated teenage children that you have to work at bringing back around, and that's not as easily done. Yes, Diane?
Maybe the scripture answered this and what you just said about being in subjection to one another, but that list of things, it never says anything about confronting the person.
No, those lists of things were just basically God's impressions of pride, what he thinks of it.
Right, but I'm saying, what is a correct response when someone...
Oh, yes, up here?
Yeah, or not deal with sin?
Right.
Like, shouldn't you confront a person, or should you not confront a person in the home? You know, like, I'm the wife, so I'm subject to my husband, but we're supposed to be in subject to one another, subjection to one another. So it sounds like we just trust God, but do we do any actions?
Exactly. I agree. He doesn't, like I said, he doesn't come out and actually say. You know, when you read the section, it was a rather short section, and that's all it really did. I pretty much wrote down exactly what he spoke of in that particular section about it. He ends it with, "That done, if you are not a player, then you need to guard your heart against resentment, being prepared at all times to forgive or give the least, if given the least opportunity. And lastly, you need to learn the enormous power of example that Peter urges for those in such situations." So it says, what should be done when the parents or just one parent or a husband will not deal with it? And it just goes on to list exactly what I put here. So he does not imply that. However, I think, yeah, you know, you should pray about it, but you also should pray that you can confront them and address them on it. But at the same time, he may be taking the posture that, okay, look, they're not ready to see that, so confrontation at this moment is not the right move. Because initially it wouldn't be, I don't think. Initially, you've had the conversation or the discussion, or in this case, it might have been an argument, and they're being very stubborn. So you know at that time their heart's not ready to see. And so you would do these things of just trusting and praying and waiting for the opportunity to arise.
Ginny Welch had given me some great advice once. She, to the subject, she said, their hearts are hardened at that point, and she said, just pray and then duck, because God will take care of it usually.
Oh, yeah.
She said, just get out of his way.
Yeah. You know, I've well, Tim and I have experienced this in our own marriage, you know, while growing, and that's just it. The biggest example we could teach our kids, if nothing else, is that marriage is not easy, and it requires growing on both parts. And to hide your, not that you want to, like, have your arguments right out in front of them, but it's okay for them to see you're not agreeing at times. And it's good for them to see how you deal with it when the other one is being stubborn. You know, you look at your child and they say, well, Dad's being very stubborn right now, or Mom's being very stubborn right now. You know, we're going to pray for him. Or not that you're, you know, if this is if the conversation takes place in front of the whole family. You know, you should include the kids, I think, because they've just witnessed this falling out and they need to know the proper way to handle it. You know, I hope if nothing else, our children realize that marriage is work. And the only way you can work through the difficulties is through going to God in prayer and praying for the other person and allowing them. And then the even better thing is to, when they do come back and ask forgiveness, you know, I think it's great for the kids to see that. I know for myself, if I make a mistake or if I, you know, wrongly blow up at my children, when I've calmed down and seen the error of my ways, I will go back to them and apologize to them and say, you know, I'm really sorry that I was being so stubborn or whatever it was, and, you know, apologize to them. They need to see that. Yes, Paul? You look like you want to say something?
I'm just thinking, there was a book that C.S. Lewis wrote called Mere Christianity.
Yep.
And one of the chapter titles in that was called The Great Sin. And I remember that what he meant as the great sin was the sin of pride.
Yep.
I guess he built the case that that was like a foundation point for all of the other sins that we typically think of maybe first, underlie.
And I apologize, I'm all flustered this morning because things weren't going the way they were supposed to, so I've basically lost my train of thought with this. But the big point I liked about this was this last section about how to handle it. It's very important, I think, that when you have been guilty of pride, to go back and be willing to apologize and ask the forgiveness, because in the home, as a parent especially, that's the biggest lesson you could teach about pride, is to be able to come back and ask forgiveness. You know, it speaks volumes to your children if you can go back and ask their forgiveness, because you've taught them the biggest lesson right there of, you know, here's a person in authority over me and they're coming to me admitting that they were wrong and they're asking for my forgiveness. And as teachers, in my case, it's very important to be able to admit that you've made a mistake in front to your students and ask their forgiveness, because when they see that, I mean, even with my little five-year-olds, they know when I've wronged them. And for me to ask their forgiveness just gives them that much more respect for me, because they realize that I care about them and respect them as a student. And they love you all the more for it. You know, they're like, wow, she actually realizes what she did. They even know at five when you make a mistake and when you're, and you can't be too proud to go back and apologize. That's the bad thing about pride, is being too proud to come back. You know, I can't admit I did wrong. I can't do that. Yeah, that's the worst part of pride. Yes, Paul.
I think when we apologize to somebody, what we're doing is we're saying implicitly that God's law is more important than me.
Right. It's the first step of submission. So, and with that, it opens the door to allow God to move so much more. And I think the worst pride is the inability to admit we've done wrong, being too afraid to admit it. Yes, Diane?
I think of the verse, humble yourself in the sight of the Lord and he will lift you up. And I also think that sometimes it's really hard to go and apologize when the other person has a little bit of pridefulness in them too, because you know you might just get it.
Yeah.
You might just get stepped on. You know, but you have to go back and humble yourself in the sight of the Lord and let God take care of it.
Exactly.
And in time, maybe it won't happen the first time, but
right.
Next time, maybe lift it up.
I like that as I've gotten older, it's become a little easier. I've been guilty of pride a lot in my younger years, I think, especially coming from my family. I think I came from a very proud family, as far as not in a good way, in a bad way. We were all too stubborn to admit we were the person in the wrong. So as time went on and I had to humble myself more, it's thankfully gotten easier. And that's what happens. The more you're able to do it, the more you do it, the more you're able to be humble when you are. And hopefully you're not so guilty of pride as you get older. You've learned your lessons. Some of us learn fast, some of us learn slow. I think blondes learn slower. Chapter 4.
Were you going to mention those examples?
Oh, yes, I'm sorry. My movie clips, I wanted them to work. I'm sorry, I'm just flustered. My movie clips, I really wanted to show. I actually just Googled it yesterday, just out of curiosity, and it brought me to a Christian website called Wing Clips. So if you want to look them up, Wing Clips, www.wingclips.com. And I typed in pride and it brought me these movie clips. Now I've seen all of these movies, so as I watched the little clips, it was neat. The one about the Ten Commandments, I put that there because it's really a fight between brothers. It's a fight of pride between brothers. You know, the one brother left his family, took on a different God, the Christian God, and the other brother, who ended up becoming Pharaoh, because he actually wasn't supposed to be Pharaoh, he's mad and he's being very proud and he won't let his brother have what he wants out of pride, I think. So he makes his whole country suffer for his pride. The next one, the Cinderella Man, was an example of a father who's not too proud to go beg for money. And in this particular clip, it showed the character Jim Braddock going to his friends who had money after his fighting career was over, and he had gone to them and said, look, I've had to farm my kids out. I've gone to get a job and there's just no jobs. I've signed up for welfare, basically. And I've come to beg you for money. And they all give it to him. They respected him for who he was, and they willingly gave it to him. But it was just a great example of a father who's not too proud to go ask for help for his family. And then the last one, Fun with Dick and Jane, was really a good one, because this was during the time of when, like, Tyco and all the other big companies were getting hit with their CEOs and their vice presidents embezzling money. So for us, it was a great movie, for Tim and I, because it hit home, because we suffered for that with Tyco. And it even lists all the corporations at the end of the movie that it was about. And Tyco was one of the companies that it listed. This guy, his job was, he just got promoted to vice president in this big company called Teledon. And he got promoted when the company was going under because they were getting caught embezzling. And so he lost his job right off the bat. And he had just bought a new house. And he just told his wife she could quit her job and stay at home and take care of their son. And he comes in and she's trying to explain to him their financial situation, where they're really in bad shape. And she goes, you might want to consider looking for a position a little less than vice president. And he's like, oh no, took me 15 years to be a vice president. I'm not about to look for something else. And after she explains her financial situation, and the clip ends, the next part is where he goes to Costco to look for a job. And Costco is like going to Walmart. So he gets the message. He wasn't too proud to hear his wife after she tried to explain everything, and he realized how bad off they were, so he was willing to go look for a job anywhere at that point. So they were examples of how, you know, you listen and you're not too proud. And they were good. But if you want to go and look them up, it's great. The next chapter was chapter 4, Holidays in the Living Room. We'll get started on it. We might not get all the way through it. It's actually interesting. Wherefore, they called these days Purim, after the name of Pur. Therefore, all the words of this letter and of that which they had seen concerning this matter and which had come unto them, the Jews ordained and took upon them and upon their seed and upon all such as joined themselves unto them, so as it should not fail that they would keep these 2 days according to their writing and according to their appointed time every year. And that's in Esther 9:26-27. And then John 10:22-23 says, and it was at Jerusalem the feast of the dedication, and it was winter, and Jesus walked in the temple of Solomon's porch. This chapter basically addresses how in today's society we have difficulty as Christians with celebrating Christmas and Easter in particular, among other holidays. But a lot of Christians today struggle with how to celebrate Christmas and Easter, especially because they don't want it to be commercialized the way it has become, the Easter Bunny and Santa Claus and all of that. And he basically says in the book that Christians can go to the extreme of not celebrating it at all, or some of them go to the extreme of making it too commercial. I brought up the Feast of Purim and the Feast of Dedications because he spoke of them, and they actually were not actual required holidays. They were holidays that they instituted, and I did look up Purim, and it was in my notes, and I don't know how to get back there. Let's see, escape. I didn't know what Purim was, so I had to look it up. And in my notes, I put down that it was a holiday established to celebrate God's deliverance of the Jews in Persia. The Book of Esther explained how the festival came to be, but in ways shows God's commanding that the festival be observed. The festival of Hanukkah was established. So I think Purim was what brought about Hanukkah, if I read it correctly. And it was also
a separate.
No, you're right, it is. I have two of them. The Feast of Hanukkah was the other one. The Feast of Purim and Feast of Dedication or Lights was what Hanukkah became. So, but these were holidays that were established early on and were just celebrated every year. So that's why I put that in there, because I didn't know what they were, and so I thought it was interesting. So I learned a lesson there of what Purim was, and I learned how Hanukkah came about. I gotta make it big so I can see it. So the importance of Purim and the Feast of Dedication or Lights were very important holidays back then to them, and they were established by the king at that time because he felt that celebrating was important for Christians to do. The importance of celebrating holidays. Let's see. There are times when the point is driven too far and taken to the extreme, causing those to differ when they reject. Not sure about that one. Right. There are times when the point is driven too far and taken to the extreme, causing those who differ with them to reject what they actually ought to listen to. That was the part about the different reasons for struggling with celebrating the holidays. Jumping down here, it says, the fact that something is lawful does not mean that those who handle it are doing so lawfully. Marriage is lawful. Can it not be abused? Beer is lawful. Is there no such thing as drunkenness? Guns are lawful. Is there no such thing as being a bad shot? The mere fact that God-honoring practices like Christmas observance in the home are lawful doesn't mean that the thing is being celebrated rightly. And that's the part about holidays can be celebrated unlawfully or wrong. And I think we'll stop there, and next week we'll just reintroduce this chapter and pick back up with it, which will be helpful because it'll allow anybody who hasn't had a chance to read much of the book yet to get there. And next week, I'd really like your ideas on Christmas and Easter, if you don't mind, with what you think about today's society and with the way we do celebrate them today, in today's society. I do know that I've really had to work hard at rethinking about Easter and how to celebrate Easter when my kids were growing up, because I didn't want to focus on the Easter basket and the Easter bunny and all of that. And that's what's so popular right now. And it was very hard raising your kids with not focusing Christmas on Santa Claus and everything, and trying to teach them about the real meaning behind Christmas, because where I grew up, it was all about Santa Claus. So it was hard changing my mindset as a Christian and reteaching my children different from what I was raised. So having said that, let's close in prayer. Ryan, would you mind closing us in prayer?
My gracious God and Heavenly Father, we